The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm Denver Frederick, and I'll be with you for the next hour as we discuss developments in the world of philanthropy and social enterprise. My guest tonight will be Mary Ellen Iskenderian, the president and CEO of Women's World Banking. She'll tell us what the mission and purpose of the organization has been for these past 40 years.
But working with those local institutions to make sure that they were providing not just loans, but savings accounts, insurance products, the whole range of financial products and services that low-income women in developing countries would really need to be both secure, to have security in their lives, but also to maximize their prosperity.
We'll also hear from Brad Smith, the CEO of Candid, which is the entity that was just created as a result of the merger between the Foundation Center and GuideStar. But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, February 24th. According to a nationwide survey, 53% of Vermont's residents earned a passing grade on a multiple-choice test of questions adapted from a U.S. citizenship exam. A majority of residents in every other state failed that exam. The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation has announced a commitment of $300 million over 5 years to strengthen journalism with a focus on local and investigative news reporting. Global suicide rates have dropped by 38% since 1994, saving 4 million lives, four times the number killed in combat during the same period. A new report showed that the global fertility rate, the average number of children a woman gives birth to, has halved since 1950. Half the world's countries are now below replacement levels. At the end of 2018, at least 32 countries around the world had a plastic bags ban in place, and nearly half of those were in Africa. The New York Academy of Sciences, Columbia University, and several other prominent universities, museums, and nonprofits are reviewing their philanthropic relationship with the Sackler family, owner of Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin, an opioid-based pain medication. This according to the Wall Street Journal. And finally, a reliable way to measure the mood of affluent donors is to study their behavior at the end of a calendar year and see what kind of contributions they made, especially to donor-advised funds. And covering that story for the Chronicle Philanthropy is Heather Jocelyn, who's with us now. Good evening, Heather.
Good evening, Denver.
So what did you see in this regard as 2018 came to a close?
Well, as everyone knows, December was quite an interesting time with the markets. It was the worst December since the Great Depression, which is not a distinction that it can be proud of. It's still a bit early, but we talked to organizations that provide donor-advised funds, National Philanthropic Trust, Vanguard Charitable, Schwab Charitable, some big community foundations, such as Community Foundations of Texas. And what we found is that they were seeing fewer donor-advised funds opened, but the ones that were, people were putting more money into them than in 2017. So generally, giving was up, but again, it's the people in the higher end of the wealth scale who were putting money in, and they were also giving fewer appreciated stocks than they usually do. Partly because
there were fewer appreciated stocks.
Yeah, true. Yes, they weren't as valuable as they had hoped they would be by the end of the year.
Yeah.
So that's what that looks like.
Yeah. Heather, did experts detect any impact from the new federal tax code?
Well, I think we won't know until what people were telling me is that we won't really know until this year is completed, because people have not done their taxes under the new tax code. So they really there are a lot of unknowns. I have heard some people say that, you know, it's possible we may see a giving bump in the spring after people have done their taxes and they realize they have more money than they thought. Another possibility is that some donors may have bundled their gifts, which means giving a larger than normal gift maybe at the end of 2017, maybe the end of 2018, with the idea that they won't give money in the next year or two in a way to maximize their tax benefits. So that's kind of an X factor. We've heard anecdotally of donors doing that, but no one has studied it yet. We don't have any hard numbers on that yet.
Finally, Heather, you know, taking this information and now observing that the stock market, boy, it's still pretty volatile. What advice would you give to fundraisers in 2019?
Get to know what your donors are thinking. See if they are thinking about bundling. If they want to give but they're worried about their stock holdings, ask them about their other assets. They may have other assets that they could give, real estate or art, even or other appreciated assets. It could be, or maybe it's a good time to talk about planned gifts. Getting to know your donors is always good advice. And we just published the annual Philanthropy Outlook Report from the Lilly Family School of Philanthropy at Indiana University in Martin Lundy. And they are predicting a 3.4% increase in giving this year. And we won't know, you know, that's pretty healthy.
Yeah.
And especially, they're especially predicting jumps in foundation giving and in bequest.
Mm-hmm.
We're definitely at a demographic, a state of things with the demographics where boomers getting older, they're just entering their 70s. It's going to be a prime time for planned giving as well.
Absolutely. Well, thanks very much, Heather, for this report.
Thank you.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving is pleased to feature news correspondents every week from the Chronicle of Philanthropy, a trusted source of daily news on the nonprofit world. A subscription to the Chronicle gets you instant access to practical online tools like checklists, resource guides, and expert advice, and in-depth insight into the big ideas and trends that are transforming the nonprofit world. Learn more at philanthropy.com. That's the Chronicle of Philanthropy at philanthropy.com. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
Across the world, there remains a very considerable gap between men and women with regard to access to finance and technology. But women's financial inclusion, in addition to improving their lot and that of their family, also has extraordinary benefits for her community, including improved water sanitation, better education, and better health. An organization who's been at the forefront of this financial inclusion movement for some 40 years now is Women's World Banking, and it's a pleasure to have with us tonight their president and CEO, Mary Ellen Iskandarian. Good evening, Mary Ellen, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thank you so much for having me.
Give us a snapshot of Women's World Banking, your mission, and what the organization was created to do.
So as you pointed out, we were created 40 years ago, just at the early, early stages of the microfinance movement. And Women's World Banking, for all of those 40 years, has really been focused working with local financial institutions. Initially, those were microfinance banks for the most part, but working with those local institutions to make sure that they were providing not just loans, but savings accounts, insurance products, the whole range of financial products and services that low-income women in developing countries would really need to be both secure, to have security in their lives, but also to maximize their prosperity. The really exciting thing, I think, about our evolution and where we are today is that there are many, many more players in this space today than just the microfinance institutions. So today, we're partnering with cell phone companies and mainstream banks and retailers, fast-moving consumer goods companies. Really, the way I think about it is any institution, organization, or company that has a distribution channel into the life of a low-income woman in a developing country is a potential partner for us to work with to deliver her financial services.
How would you describe your role in this larger ecosystem as you're trying to get these low-income women in developing countries to connect with the financial institution. What role, what exactly do you do?
So our major role really is as a connector, I guess you'd say, but in a couple of senses. So we have three main lines of business, really. The first is there's a very strong correlation between diversity, gender diversity in the management and the governance of a financial service provider and that organization's outreach to women clients. So we have a very long established, well established training program that we provide to senior executives and high potential women. They come into the program together. Our academic partner is the Wharton School of Business, and they go through 9 months of training together on why gender diversity is important, why financial inclusion is important, why women are great customers. But they're also working together on what we call a strategic business initiative. So they're looking at something that will either increase their outreach to women clients or the number of women clients. And I think that's really where we've seen some really exciting outcomes when these senior executives who tend to be more men than women, yeah, and the high potential women joining together to solve a common problem. We're very excited. First week of April, we're going to be rolling out a very similar program. There are our academic partner will be Oxford University, for financial regulators. So insurance regulators, central bank governors, because there's very little understanding of the importance of gender diversity, let alone gender diversity itself in the institutions that are doing this regulation. So that's one line of business. Mm-hmm. The second is the one I think we're probably best known for, where we'll go into a financial institution and we'll either look at, and I'd say this is turning out to be the biggest line of business right now, is we'll look at a product that it's probably a good product and maybe is very popular with low-income men or they've had some success, but it's just not resonating with women. And we'll look at whether that's because the onboarding process doesn't make sense, the marketing doesn't make sense, or whether the things that the product can do just aren't things that women need it for. And we've got, you know, examples of all of those things. So that acting as that interlocutor, telling the organization what it is they need to be doing, changing, tweaking very often. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's not a very big
just
change.
Just reframe a little.
And then the third line of business, and I know we'll talk about this a little bit later in more depth, is we've become an investor in these financial institutions. And we've just found that the impact you can have as a shareholder, as a board member, really sitting inside a company is turning out to be far greater than what we are able to have even just as a consultant or an advisor to that organization.
How many people in the world are excluded from the formal financial system? And of those, how many of them are women?
So the official number mm-hmm. of excluded people is just at 2 billion. Of that, the number of women is about 1.1 billion. Mm-hmm. But I, at the risk of getting a little nuanced here, what that number really refers to is only whether or not you have a bank account in your own name. It doesn't say anything about whether you're using that bank account, whether you have any services that you really need from that bank account. It just means you have an account in your name. And so, unfortunately, what we're seeing is, as there's been a dramatic improvement, and really there's been tremendous change in the last 3 years alone, over half a billion new accounts have been opened, but they're not being used.
Yeah.
And that's really where the game is shifting and where I think Women's World Banking's role is taking on particular importance.
Do women face any unique barriers that men don't face in terms of getting included in the financial system?
Interesting that you use the word unique, because, you know, our experience is that low-income men and women both face significant barriers that are often very similar. It's just they seem to hit women even harder. Huh. One of the single greatest issues, not only in just getting access to finance, but getting access to the formal economy more broadly, is lack of identification. Does the woman have, or the man, have anything that he or she can demonstrate that he is who he says he is, or she is who she says she is? And those issues can really be compounded for women in many countries, women's, you know, girls' births aren't even recorded.
Yeah.
You know, in Bangladesh, they made a huge step forward about 18 months ago because it was you were required to have a birth certificate in order to get a SIM card for your cell phone. And women's births aren't recorded. There aren't birth certificates for girls. So right out of the gate, you know, there was just a woman was going to be denied that access. So the government of Bangladesh has changed that requirement. But that issue of identity is just huge for women. You also see, you know,
no access to government services, getting to school, all those things we take for granted just
exactly,
don't exist.
Because you can't prove
who you are.
I think one thing that if there were a unique aspect, it would probably be some cultural and social norms that again sort of hit women harder than they might do for men. They're in many countries, their mobility outside of the home is constrained.
Yeah.
Even the owning of a cell phone is suspect. Is it going to be can she be contacted by another man?
Mm-hmm.
And so her husband might be reluctant to let her
have
that access. So getting past those cultural issues can often be difficult for women.
What happens to a woman when she gains control over her own finances?
You know, it truly is transformative. I mean, this is really the exciting part. There is just a whole wealth of evidence that shows that a household that has a woman with more control over the resources, either by virtue of her bringing more income in or if there's a government payment that's coming, you know, directly to her and she has some say over how that gets spent, is just a healthier, better fed, and better educated household. There's a dramatic impact on the welfare of the people in that household if the woman has more say and more control over the financial resources.
Is there a relationship between domestic violence against women and self-sustainability on the part of the woman?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that question because it's really one of the saddest and naughtiest issues that we see, and the relationship between physical security and financial security is so strong. So the research is actually a little contradictory in a sense, but what it appears is that if a woman is living in a country where culturally she can get out of a marriage that's a violent one,
mm-hmm.
having more financial resources in her own name is undeniably a positive thing.
I bet.
It can play both ways,
yeah.
However, if she is in a more traditional cultural or one where she would be, you know, terribly ostracized from society if she were to leave the marital home, then having more income, having more control over resources can often increase violence.
Mm-hmm.
We see a pretty clear pattern in the microfinance world where when a woman first becomes a borrower, unfortunately, we often see a spike
mm-hmm.
in domestic violence where a woman is more susceptible to intimate partner violence. But then we also happily see a pretty consistent pattern that once her partner sees sort of two things. One, that there's more income in the household. People are, you know, breathing a little bit easier. The month to month is a little bit less stressful. And when he recognizes that he's not the only one in the village or the town that's allowing, quote unquote, his wife
to disappear.
Yeah. Those two things seem to really reduce the level of domestic violence below where it might have been before. One more quick thing that I always find absolutely fascinating. The data also clearly shows us that the single sort of silver bullet, if there were one, is around property rights.
Mm-hmm.
Making sure that a woman's name is on the title to whatever property they're farming or they're owning or the man and wife are sharing is almost a guarantee that he's going to have to deal with her.
Yeah.
And so
they're equals and they're partners.
Exactly.
And it changes the dynamic dramatically.
Precisely.
So I'm a banker and I'm dealing with a woman in this developing world right now and I want to get her business. What are the most important considerations for her as I try to get her business?
That's a great question. So we see that, you know, what I always find it amazing that bankers don't just ask the women and don't just listen to the women about what they want. They're usually pretty clear. We found, though, that there are a couple of signature things that if you don't have in a financial product, a woman is just not going to listen to you. One is really convenience. You've mm-hmm. got to make it really easy. And indeed, to the extent that you can bring it to her, which is why we are so excited about cell phone banking. There, the bank is literally in your hand.
Yep.
If you can bring that product to her, she's going to like it a whole lot more. She also needs to know that she's physically secure, that it's that, you know, she's not going to be at greater risk of physical security by carrying around a lot of cash or being exposed in any way. But I think a very salient point that is we see much more with women than with men is confidentiality.
Yeah, I bet.
Women really don't necessarily want their husbands or their fathers or even their neighbors really to know that they're saving or that what they might be saving towards. Being able to keep that to themselves is a really important factor in their decision to choose a product or not.
Is it true that women demand a lot more information before making a financial decision?
No, it's true. Yeah. They take a lot longer. And that's true really everywhere.
Yeah.
Fidelity has done some studies here in the United States on just how much longer and how much information a woman needs to feel comfortable to establish trust with the financial service provider before she, you know, signs her name on the dotted line.
But they're great customers once they do.
They're very loyal customers. That's the big payoff. You're absolutely right. Women are more loyal customers. There's some really fun data around net promoter scores around,
yeah.
you know, women will be much more likely to recommend a mm-hmm. financial service provider that she trusts than a man would. But boy, is she going to talk about service that she's not happy with much more so than men will as well.
That sounds like a double-edged sword to me. You better service her well. We talked a little bit about the suite of products women need, and so much of it is a bank account people think about, but it's gotten way beyond that. Talk about what that suite exists of and what products women are availing themselves of.
So the microfinance movement really centered itself around credit, and
mm-hmm.
often credit for informal enterprises. So businesses that, you know, might be home-based or only have the woman and maybe her spouse or one or two employees, but really weren't formal businesses. But we started to see that where women would really be drawn into the formal sector was the ability to have a safe place to save. We see all around the world that women have a much greater, you know, the economists were here, their jargon is propensity to save than men do, and are usually doing it in the mattress or in little envelopes that they hide around the house,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, if we go back to those three issues that we know the women really like to see in a product, isn't really very secure. So we've seen women really make a shift into the formal financial sector if she can be guaranteed that safe place to save. The third thing that's kind of been added to the tripod that Women's World Banking has been very excited about providing to women is insurance.
Mm.
And a few years ago, we very successfully launched a very simple product that we've called the caregiver, so that a woman, because we were finding a couple of things. We were finding that women were saving 10 to 15% of monthly income. It's a lot of money being saved when you don't have a lot of money coming in, purely in the case of health emergencies, just to be sure that they wouldn't be, you know, drawn right back into poverty if a family member got sick. We also saw that women were always willing to deprioritize their own health, except in the case of pregnancy. During pregnancy, a woman will make sure that she's being healthy. So we designed a product that could take care of health emergencies, had to cover maternal health as well, and that would provide a woman with basically a per diem that was equal to a day's wage,
mm-hmm.
essentially, in the event that she or a family member had to have a hospital stay. And it's really been tremendously successful. We've rolled it out now in 6 different countries. What we find really fascinating is that that cash payment, that per diem, is tremendously tremendously needed and well received by women across different countries. But what it's used for is really different. In Uganda, for example, the ability to pay for transportation to the healthcare facility is literally the deciding factor on whether or not you will go to the hospital or not. And so we saw that cash payment being used to guarantee transport. In Egypt, the cost of there was government health insurance for the hospital stay, but it didn't cover prescription drugs. Mm. And the cost of prescription drugs, like here in the States, is really prohibitive. So we saw a lot of that cash payment going not for the hospital stay, but to make sure that the drugs that they went home with, could be paid for.
Very interesting. You know, you mentioned cell phones before. So let's talk a little bit about the role of technology in advancing your work and what you do to create a balance between that technology and that all-important human interaction that's needed to engage these women. Talk about that.
So the role of cell phone technology and digital financial services in reaching previously excluded people cannot be overestimated. It has completely changed the conversation. It has made all of the things that we're talking about here today solvable problems. And I have absolute confidence that we will be reaching those 2 billion people who currently don't have access, and they will largely be reached through digital technology. But what we're also seeing is that it's not just you hand somebody a cell phone and they understand it, immediately. You've got to make sure that there is not only financial education, but then digital education, mm-hmm. so that both men and women understand how the phone gets used and what it is best used for. Unfortunately, we have about 300 million fewer phones owned by women than by men. And so literally just access to the technology, because remembering that confidentiality issue, a woman may be very happy sharing a phone to make a phone call or get, weather information if she's got crops. But she's very clear with us. She's not going to bank on a phone that she shares with another family member.
Yeah.
So getting something, again, that she controls and that she can keep private is really critical. But part of that whole education process we're learning is to balance the human interaction. Just have a minute for a quick story. One of our most exciting and I think most successful interactions was with a large bank in Nigeria that wanted to make their first foray. They were the fourth largest corporate bank in Nigeria. They had not built much of a retail presence. They recognized that the 56% of the Nigerian population that weren't banked were probably where their future was, but they wanted to do it digitally. And so they brought us in to help design a very simple transactional savings account. And we built, so it could be accessed by your cell phone, it could be accessed at an ATM. It was, very, very easy access. But we built this sort of group of people that the name of the account was called Beta. And we built this group of people who went around to the different clients. It was mostly for shopkeepers and these large open air bazaars that you see all over Nigeria that were called Beta Friends. Mm-hmm. And our idea for this was that they would provide basic information about setting up the account and a little financial education about how the account actually worked. Flash forward a few years, we see fully 69% of all the deposits made through that account are made from that face-to-face interaction with the Beta friend who goes around to the businesses. We've had both men and women say to us, I feel an obligation. This person is coming to my business. If I don't have a deposit for him or her, I feel I'm letting them down. They become really part of that person's life, and there's a real, a real resonance between those two individuals.
And a lot of trust.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You don't get trust
human
from a cell phone necessarily.
No, exactly.
You know?
So the cell phone has dramatically made it more efficient to service that customer, but that face-to-face interaction can't be forgotten.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I don't think a lot of people appreciate what your organization does in terms of focusing on the impact on the bank. We always think of the women and the family and the community, but you really have to have the banks involved in a very self-enlightened way, and you've worked very hard at that.
Yeah, that's probably the hardest nut to crack,
yeah.
Really. And you know, we've found that, you know, you've got to have a bank or a cell phone company or, you know, whoever we're working with that at least has acknowledged that financial inclusion might be an important thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the case of the cell phone companies, they're all about increasing subscribers. So if I can say to them, you know, you are dramatically underreaching this, you know, 50% of your population that you could be going after, that gets their attention. So you've got to be able to present a business case to them, but understand, you know, where their business case is coming from. You know, one of the things that we're saying to a lot of banks today is, you know, where there have been these big government pushes towards financial inclusion, there's all these accounts have been opened up and then they're just lying dormant. It's super expensive for a bank to leave a bank account unused. And so we can make the case for we can get that account, we can turn that account
activated
into an active account.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And not only stop the hemorrhaging from the losing money, but actually have you making money for with that account.
Yeah, another good story took place in Pakistan. When you were looking to deliver banking services to low-income women in rural Pakistan, and this was no easy task. Tell me how you were able to crack that nut.
Yeah. Well, that's a great example of so many of the things that we've talked about. So there was the largest cell phone provider in Pakistan. It's a company that recently changed its name. Its name is now Jazz, and they had what's called a mobile wallet called Jazz Cash, which allows you to perform a whole series of financial services just directly on your cell phone. I'm convinced the reason they even looked at this number is because their chief digital officer was a woman.
Mm-hmm.
But she looked and saw that only 12% of their clients were women. And so she actually asked us to come in thinking she needed a woman's product. But when we took another look at the data, the women, that 12% were using exactly the same products that men were using, exactly the same volumes. They were absolutely as profitable as the men were. Where their problem was is that the way their main acquisition channel, the way you were onboarded as a customer of Jazz Cash, was through a nationwide network of agents. So these were largely, you know, mom and pop, but really pop shops around the country, where you would go and open an account. So as I alluded, 95% of these agents of Jazz around the country were men. And if the intrepid Pakistani woman went into a shop, which really started to, you know, rub up against some of the cultural and social norms in Pakistan, if she went into the shop, she then had to give that man her cell phone number.
Oh, yeah, all her information.
Right.
That's
and
not going to happen.
No, just not going to happen. Exactly. Exactly. So where we looked at working with Jazz was to partner with Unilever, who had already established this nationwide network of women shopkeepers
mm-hmm.
who were selling all of the Unilever products. They had done an excellent job in picking, you know, highly respected women in the community already and trusted women in the community. And so we trained them to be agents for Jazz Cash. It was a significant additional source of monthly revenue for that woman shopkeeper. She was already a trusted person in the village, so both the woman and her husband was comfortable with her, engaging with her, doing business with her. And Jazz has not only increased its number of women agents has gone up by 49%, but the number of women who are actively transacting on the Jazz Cash platform has really skyrocketed. So it's been, so far, a real win-win-win for everybody.
Yeah, it always makes sense to plug into those established lines of communication instead of recreating the wheel.
Oh, absolutely.
And it really makes an awful lot of sense. You mentioned a while back about this impact investing fund. I know you set it up a couple of years ago. I think it was $50 million. Give us an update on that and some of the things it's been able to achieve.
So the fund, what really came out of this kind of intellectual or this research that we had done about, oh, I'd say about 7 or 8 years ago, we had tracked whether what happened when a microfinance institution decided to move from being a nonprofit entity to becoming a fully fledged bank. Mm-hmm. And we looked at a, you know, pretty robust sample size of about 39 institutions. And unfortunately, we saw that from the start of when they were going through this process of becoming banks, they went from an average 86% women clients to 4 years later, an average of 59% women clients. And what happened in leadership and governance and the staff was a bloodbath. There was this almost across the board, all of them had been run by incredibly talented women. But somehow when you became a bank, you had to have a male CEO, you had to have a male chairman of the board. So we wanted, so we'd done this piece of research. We were shocked that it turned out to be as bad as as it did. And so we thought we should be that investor that says, no, after you bring in outside capital, after you make that change from nonprofit to for-profit, you should stay with the women clients and the staff and diversity structure that got you there, that got you that great success. And so out of that, our $50 million Women's World Banking Capital Partners was born. We have deployed that full amount. Our investment period ended this past June.
Mm-hmm.
We've made 10 investments. I am absolutely delighted to tell you that on average, we've had a 46% increase in women clients in all of our investees since the date of our investment.
Fantastic.
And each one of our investees leads their market in terms of gender diversity. I think we've done a really good job in not just being the only voice for gender diversity, but making sure that all the shareholders who are investing alongside us are united in making sure management understands the importance of this. Our favorite story of the moment is there's a wonderful bank in Bolivia that we became a shareholder in. They were terrific. 84% of their clients were women. They were really doing well, but their internal diversity was pretty bad. And we set some pretty firm targets when we invested 3 years ago, and management kept missing the targets. And so the compensation committee of the board, where Women's World Banking does not sit, we're not represented there, mm-hmm. they said, all right, let's take this seriously. And they tied the CEO's bonus to his ability to hit those diversity targets. He got his bonus in 2018. He hit those targets. So it really...
You didn't even need to finish that sentence.
Yeah, it can really, really work. But I think it's not... We can't be the only people in the room who are making that case.
Right. Well, all this wonderful work you do doesn't happen by magic. So who are some of your partners and financial supporters that make it possible?
Oh, that's always a great question to answer. I mean, we've been so fortunate over the years to have... the support of some European, or currently we've also got Australia, so European and Australia governments who fund, you know, all of our work. They're important core funders. Currently, Sweden and Australia provide support for our entire strategic plan, but we have important support from Germany, from the UK, from a lot of other mm-hmm. Of European governments. We were absolutely delighted in October of 2017 to receive a very significant grant from Visa Foundation. We were the inaugural grant of their newly formed
foundation.
And it was very significant. Yes, it was. It was a real game changer for us. What we do is very clearly understood, I think, by a lot of the banks and financial service providers. So they've often been quite supportive of the work that we're doing as well.
You know, I've heard such wonderful things about your corporate culture. Tell us a little bit about it and what you do to shape it and influence it, and what you believe makes it such a special place in which to work.
Well, that's wonderful that you're hearing that, because I think the overarching thing that I'd say about our culture is the people bring a huge sense of passion and responsibility for the lives of the women that they're trying to help and they're trying to give a voice to. And I think that really shapes why they're there and how they act together. I have to say right now we're in a really important inflection point. Some of it motivated by that large visa grant because we really had to start thinking in larger terms than we had before. We also wanted to really start acting more at scale. We have a real history of making tremendous change at an individual institution level, but we've still got, you know, a billion unbanked women, probably closer to 2 billion if you think about underbanked and not getting all of the services they need. And so we really needed to start working at more at a systemic level, at a market level. And it's been fascinating over the course of the last year as we've put that strategy in place how important change management has been. And I think that's where my leadership team and I are really focused right now, is making sure that as we shift from what was a very successful strategy, but just trying to make a bigger impact, we're very clear to everyone in the organization what the impact on them is and why we're doing this and where they fit into that puzzle. Because I think if you don't communicate, and you leave a vacuum, people start to fill in the blanks, and they typically fill them in with the worst possible scenarios.
That's what a grapevine is. That's why you need transparency. And
exactly.
It does sound like whatever has gotten you here is not going to get you there.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And I also think it's important, I'd like to get your thinking on this as well, is that it's important for people to know what's going to stay the same. Because I think in change management, everybody's focused on what's going to change. But, you know, a lot of what you're doing is going to remain the same. And if you can anchor them in that, it's easier for them then to adapt to the change that's going to be coming down the pike.
That is such an insightful comment. And I think that in some ways that may even have been harder. People got – we had a very very inclusive strategy development process. A lot of people in the organization were bought into it. So they saw the change, but I think it was even harder. You're spot on. It was even harder to communicate, this is what we're keeping. This is what is not changing. This is what is still absolutely, you know, going forward. I do think the one thing that I do think everyone grasps is that the mission, that serving low-income women, will not budge, will not change. And that's absolutely at the core of who we are.
Mm-hmm. You know, we mentioned earlier that you will be celebrating or are celebrating your 40th anniversary. And you're going to commemorate that at an event here in New York on April 4th. Tell us about that.
Well, thank you so much for bringing it up. Yes, this is our 40th anniversary. We are actually one of fewer organizations than I'd realized that have been, you know, sort of focused on women's economic empowerment that are still around and perhaps even flourishing and even more relevant than we were when we were first created. So we'll be celebrating all year long at events in different parts of the world because we are a global organization, but our home base is here in New York. So we're absolutely thrilled. April 4th from 6 to 9 at the IAC building. If there's any interest in tickets, please go online to womensworldbanking.org. It's the first thing that pops up when you go on the on the website. It's going to be, I think it's going to be a wonderful party with many of our original partners. We really wanted to make it about saying thank you, acknowledging all of the people who helped us get where we are today.
Let me close with this, Mary Ellen. At the end of the day, this all comes down to helping one woman, one family, at a time. Share with us the story of one that you've had the pleasure of meeting and what the work of Women's World Banking has meant to her and her family.
Well, the story that I always sort of go back to because it had such an impact on my own life. Mm-hmm. I came to Women's World Banking after a long career at the World Bank. And so I thought I had been doing development for many, many years, but really saw upon coming to Women's World Banking what the lives of the people that we were working with on the ground really looked like. And so a woman that I met on my first trip to Africa with Women's World Banking, Joyce Wafuko, is the story I return to time and again. Joyce is a client still to this day of Kenya Women's Finance, which is one of our longest and oldest partners. The iconic chair of that organization will be at our April 4th event.
Mm-hmm.
But Joyce was in lived in a small town outside of Mombasa in Kenya. And, you know, her husband had had really no luck in sort of putting a job together and had gone into the city, had gone to Mombasa to become a police chief. He was sending money home, or police officer, excuse me. He was sending money home, but really not enough for Joyce and their kids to live on. And so she really needed a business, but wasn't sure exactly what to do. But she'd noticed how many of her neighbors, you know, were constantly upgrading and refurbishing their homes. And there was nothing even remotely like a hardware store in the village or anywhere near it. So she thought that would be a good business to go into. So I only saw a picture of what her original business was, but it literally was a shack on the side of the road. Mm-hmm. It had a couple of, you know, used 2x4s, some nails, some eggs, and some tomatoes. So not the Home Depot that we're all familiar with. But I was meeting her when standing in her business 7 years later. It was a beautiful store that had all sorts of workmen coming and going. She had managed to get a loan from Kenya Women's. She'd gotten some financial training. The original loan was only $70. Mm-hmm. No other bank would think about lending to her. She had kind of exhausted all of her friends and family and their savings. But if she really wanted to grow her business, so Kenya Women's made her first loan. She had a savings account with them. She was, you know, very, very proud of the fact that she now had 25 employees in this business, and that her 26th employee, her husband, had just come back to open sort of a sideline business, a lumber yard out behind the main store. But what I think the thing that just stays in my mind from that conversation and that I've never forgotten is that, you know, I sort of went into banker mode and started asking her about, you know, how much does this cost and what is her profitability on these different businesses and how much was she going to invest in the lumberyard? And she could totally answer all those questions. Mm-hmm. But it was very clear very quickly that the things that she thought of as marking her success and why she did what she did and why this was important to her were the fact that all of her children had gone through secondary education. She had put her younger sister through graduate education. All of them had, you know, were in good health, had 3 healthy square meals a day. It was really the thing that made the difference for her was not only the growth of the business. She was absolutely a proud entrepreneur, but it was what she was able to do for her family and her community that really mattered. And that made such an impact on me and has really been borne out by women all over the world.
Not to mention her sense of self-worth.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. The roof. Well, Mary Ellen Iskandarian, the president and CEO of Women's World Banking, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website, what listeners will find there in addition to the April 4th event, and how they can get involved.
So it's very simple. It's womensworldbanking.org. And there you'll find we have a very popular blog that both our staff and guest writers participate in, all of our latest research, some great photography that our team loves to post. Really, all the latest information on what's going on in the world of women's financial inclusion and why it's such an important ingredient to women's ultimate empowerment.
Well, thanks, Mary Ellen. It was a delight to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Technology can change lives, but underserved communities around the world have yet to experience all the benefits technology offers. Benetech is a nonprofit whose mission is to empower communities in need by creating scalable technology solutions. Their work has transformed how 500,000 people with disabilities access information, made it easier and safer for human rights defenders to document violations, and equipped environmental conservationists to protect ecosystems. Learn more by visiting Benetech.org. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
Can you help me remember how to smile? Make it somehow all seem worthwhile.
It's still early in 2019, but we already know that one of the most significant developments in the world of philanthropy for this year will be the merger of the two largest data and information nonprofit organizations, the Foundation Center and GuideStar. And here to discuss this with us is Brad Smith, the former head of the Foundation Center and now the CEO of this new entity, which is called Candid. Good evening, Brad.
Good to talk to you, Denver.
Boy, this is exciting news. How long has this been in the works, and what was the impetus behind this merger?
Yeah, the first conversations actually date all the way back to early 2009 when I had recently become the president of Foundation Center and reached out to Bob Ottenhoff, who was then the GuideStar president. We began to talk about the fact that there really hadn't been much collaboration between the two organizations, that maybe we should start to explore that, and that those talks continued to mature. And in early 2012, we actually hired an external consulting firm to make the case for merging the two organizations. And at the time, they came back with kind of a surprising an answer, which surprised them and us, that said, wait a minute, not so fast. You're actually quite different. The way you handle information and data is really quite distinct. And actually, the audiences you serve don't overlap that much. But here's what you could do to work together, save costs. So we started down that path. We negotiated some things like joint outsourcing agreements. We worked on some joint projects. And Jacob Harrell came into GuideStar at the end of 2012. We continued those explorations. And in 2017, we brought back the same consultants early in the year. And this time around, they said, we think it makes perfect sense. Both organizations have evolved. The field has really changed, and technology's changed. Mm-hmm. And one of the most important things is that the 990 tax returns filed by nonprofits and foundations now are, or at least the bulk of them, are made available as machine-readable open data. So that changes your cost structure. It changes the whole nature of producing information on the field. And we think that both organizations have really evolved to the point where this makes great sense.
You know, and such an interesting name, Candid, followed by a period. How did you land on that?
Yes. Well, it's a fascinating process. And I've been through branding exercises that were really kind of frustrating, where you kind of felt like you were paying a consulting firm to basically learn about your organization and then recycle your ideas to you. But we did an RFP, which is the way you're supposed to do these things. And we picked a really great firm called Open.
Mm-hmm.
And they took a lot of time looking at the brands in the field, the taglines in the field, the mission statements in the field. They read a lot of our own historical information. Remember, Foundation Center goes back to 1956, and GuideStar goes back to the birth of the internet in the mid-90s. And they started to come up with this idea of one-word names. We'd already decided that we weren't going to call it Foundation Center. We did want to consider GuideStar as a strong brand, as mm-hmm. one of the potential names. But overall, the staff and the leadership felt if we could come up with a new name, it would really help create this kind of new organization. And when they hit upon the word Candid, we all kind of scratched our heads and said, huh? And then the more we began to think about it, it does a lot of work for one word. It captures the historical approach of both organizations to information about the sector. Both of us have built up reputations for being fair and objective in producing information that people can trust, which is an incredibly valued asset in today's information-wary world. The other thing it does is it works really well as an adjective. It's a real word. It's not one of those kind of, pseudo-Latin words that people come up with.
Right.
And just begin to imagine, like, GuideStar has a really good report they do every year on the GuideStar report on nonprofit compensation.
Mm-hmm.
Think of that as the Candid report on nonprofit compensation. And you begin to get ideas of how this can be used. And together with the style guides and the kind of visual look we want to give the new organization, we felt it conveyed both the historical ethos of the organization, but also something that was kind of fresh and modern.
Yeah, I agree. And I like it. Is there an estimated cost of what it's going to take to put the two organizations together? And do you have plans to try to go out and raise some of that money?
Yeah, we do. We have put together a campaign, a capital campaign. And, part of the campaign is really about the actual integration of both organizations, which is the overall campaign is around $50 million.
Mm.
And within that, about $18 or $19 million over 3 years is actually the physical and cultural integration of the two organizations. Those costs, some people ask, well, why does it cost that much? We're quite different than a lot of nonprofits, and we're not sort of, you know, service organizations that have a website. We have huge stores of data, content, video. We do a lot of machine learning. Between the two of us, we have 30 different business systems because we have budgeting, accounting, time allocation, order processing, you know, credit card transactions, all that kind of stuff because of, you know, we have earned income through subscription products. And integrating, bringing all those systems together and making the right decisions requires a lot of professional services, software expenses, and even things like cloud expenses. We're consolidating most of our data and web properties and software applications in the Amazon cloud for lots of reasons. So all that costs quite a bit of money and takes time. So that's a big chunk of it. The rest of it is for ongoing general support from likely funders because we also were quite unique in that we have over 16 million people that use our information 24/7. So we have to keep running the whole time we're building this new airplane. So we have to keep flying it. So the general support is really important, especially for the 99% or more of people that use our service absolutely free. And then there's another piece of it, which is to strengthen the reserves that the Foundation Center is bringing in, because reserves are important for the long-term viability of the organization. And then something kind of experimental, which is an internal venture fund, where we can actually loan ourselves money as if it was internal venture capital to develop new products and services that we can then pay back to this fund. So that all adds up to a lot of money. And, you know, we're doing well with the fundraising. We have not reached that goal, but the response of foundations has been very encouraging.
Yeah, well, that's great. And it's great to have a little bit of money for innovation and opportunities that come along and that you're not completely pinned down. Finally, Brad, for the consumer who uses this data, what will be the benefit to them of this combined entity?
Yeah, the immediate benefits are people going to see. And one of the messages we have is that if you're already using Foundation Center and GuideStar products like Charity Check or GuideStar Professional or Foundation Director Online, that you will continue to get the same kind of quality and service that you've been getting. In the relatively short term, you'll begin to see richer information in those products as we begin to sort of cross-pollinate those products and services with the GuideStar information about nonprofits and the Foundation Center information about foundations and grants, and particularly a lot of the international information that Foundation Center brings. Also, we're going to be doing something which is a little geeky, but we're going to be using machine learning to auto-code all of the GuideStar data, what that will mean for the user is it'll be you have a much better search experience. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be tied as much to knowing broadly what an organization does or what the exact name of the organization is. And that information is really important because that information not only flows through GuideStar's products, but if you use Amazon Smile, for example, if you picked a nonprofit to have, I think it's 0.05% of your purchases you make on Amazon be donated to that nonprofit, the information you're getting about that nonprofit is coming from GuideStar. Similar on Facebook, there's a data pipe from GuideStar into Facebook that allows you to create a campaign for your favorite nonprofit. With this information now being auto-coded and enriched, you're going to be able to search, for example, by a cause. Let's say you want to fund toxic waste sort of treatment or environmental, you know, consequences of toxic waste in a given state or something, you'll be able to sort of type in a natural language phrase and get a whole list of organizations that are working on that issue rather than knowing the organization in advance. And then I think a little further down the road, we do have ideas for new products and services that will make possible. And I think one of the biggest wins is that the two organizations together will be able to bring much more standardization of information to the field and a lot less duplication of effort. Right now, a nonprofit, you know, has to fill out the same organizational information about themselves on a zillion different platforms, really, zillion different purposes. We feel the weight of the new organization will make it possible to make the profiles that people fill out that are now part of Candid sort of flow through grant application systems, even perhaps government contracting. And we'll just be able to sort of reduce the waste and so that nonprofits can really get to doing the work they want to do to make the world better.
Wow, this is all very exciting. I want to thank you so much, Brad. And I also hope that this serves as a model and an inspiration of sorts for some other organization in the sector who would really do well to combine their efforts with another entity. Really, the best of luck to you and Jacob in this new venture.
Well, thanks so much, and thanks for everything you do for the field as well.
And that is this week's show. Next week, my guests will be Laura Sparks, the president of the Cooper Union, and Ben Irwin, president of Charity Buzz, the premium online charity auction site. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and do return next Sunday evening for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.